Parents think that certain subjects are adult subjects, or maybe they're just taboo. That open, honest communication with your child can solve just so many conceptual problems.
You're listening to The Brendan Murata Show.
In this episode, I talked to Megan Russell, Chief Operating Officer at Murata Wealth Management, about how to set your children up for financial success. Megan is my sister, and she's also one of the best parents that I know. And in this episode, we talk about how your parenting can actually influence your child's future relationship to money. Listening to Megan talk, I became aware of many of my own beliefs around money that no longer served me, and saw ways that I could give my children a better experience and relationship to money. Regardless of your income or financial status, this episode has lessons that everyone can use to improve their relationship to money and their children's relationship to money. Now, here is Megan. Today we're talking about how to set your children up for financial success. And I want to start with the question, how early can you start? Because I think that many people start thinking about their finances when they need them, not necessarily when the best time to prepare is. So they think about, you know, their kids' future when they're maybe getting into high school, or they think about their retirement when they're a couple of years out from it. So when we talk about setting your children up for financial success, how early can that start?
Well, you can always start right now.
Okay.
Just like everybody else, kids learn best by seeing a good example. And so even if you don't have children yet, start cultivating in yourself the financial habits you want your kids to have. That way, when you eventually do have kids, they're going to pick up the habits that are the right ones to have. So setting them up for success starts by setting yourself up for success. And then once your child is born, just like reading, you can start on day one. Like, kids are learning as soon as they come out. Kids are even learning when they're inside the uterus. I mean, can they learn money stuff in there? Maybe not. They're probably just picking up language, but even picking up some of the language can be helpful. It's never too early to start.
I've heard it said that children copy whatever you do. So if you want to teach your kids better, you actually have to work on yourself and become a better person, which is both the good news and the bad news. The good news being that if you do internal work, that your kids will emulate that. And that also, they might pick up all your bad habits.
It's so true.
What are the habits or ways of thinking about money or habits around money that you want to develop in yourself and then also show your children so that they emulate those?
Well, obviously, that's a big question because finances touches so many parts of our lives that there's a lot of places where you probably have some bad habits that, you know, fixing would be helpful. That being said, I think thrift and frugality is really a good place to start. It's something that kids can kind of picture early on. So things like comparison price shopping, learning to wait, you know, like, maybe I don't need to buy that right now. I should wait and see if I really want it. Those kinds of self-restraint issues will help them in all areas of their life. That'll also help them, you know, on the playground when their friends are playing with something they want to play with. Those kinds of same lessons will apply again. On the topic, though, of your kids reflecting back what you do, it is very funny having a child because you can see them trying on your personality. So it'll be like, they'll be them, they'll be doing stuff that's definitely them. But then all of a sudden, they'll just kind of try on what you would do in that moment. And they'll be like, oh, excuse me, I'm so sorry I bumped into you. And you're like, that was definitely my phrase you just quoted back to me. Other times you'll see them trying on someone else, like, oh, that was your grandfather. I just saw that come out. So they definitely are learning and trying on and seeing what fits them. What do they like doing?
That very much sounds like the French philosopher René Girard. He has the mimetic theory of learning, that basically we learn what we want by watching others and then adopting not just their habits, but their desires.
Interesting.
His whole theory is basically that we see others doing certain roles and think, if I become what that person is, I'll get whatever I perceive them as having. So if children see you as something that they want to emulate, then, oh, if I act like them, then I'll have what they have. And it's interesting because you mentioned the idea of waiting to buy something. That was definitely something I learned growing up and then had to unlearn in certain situations, because in certain situations that wasn't adaptive. And in other situations, it was adaptive. It sounds like when it comes to money, there's the same mindset work anywhere else where you have to like go through all the ideas and beliefs you've been given and figure out which actually serve you and which don't, and that your children are going to unconsciously try them on and see what works for them.
It's true. Yeah. I think that kids learn a lot by watching. So they learn a lot by watching us do things. But at the end of the day, you have to have experience actually having money and making the decisions. If you don't have that experience, it's like trying to theoretically teach someone how to walk. Okay, so then you put your foot. No, like your kid needs to try it. They need to try it. They need to fall over. They need to stand up again. So definitely kids need to be able to make real choices with their own real money. I think the earlier that you can start that, the better. My daughter, we had a piles and piles of pennies. So this is like long before she could work for any money. We just had piles of pennies and none of us wanted to do anything with it because it was like, who wants to go pay for something that costs $16 with pennies? Like no one wants to do that. But we gave them all to her when she was like two. We said, all right, here you go. Here's a whole bunch of pennies. You can spend this on something. This is going to be your starter money. So she went and she, you know, got to comparison shop. We had $16 of pennies and she got to comparison shop what she wanted to buy. And my goodness, it was so interesting to watch her make those first decisions as she's picking something up and she's realizing, well, this one costs too much. I could get five of these. I could just get one of those. It was really cool to watch her settle on what she was finally going to get.
You know, it reminds me of the Montessori method of teaching. And so actually, I want to ask, how is it you give children the opportunity to make real meaningful choices about money? One of the things that me and Christina were talking about was we saw a video of a child who had a small kitchen that parents had gotten that was at her level. So she's 3 years old. It's very close to the ground. Mm. And it had all of her snacks in it and everything she needed to make snacks. They were still making food for her. They were taking care of her. But she also, if she wanted, had kitchen tools that were at her height and her level that she could use and make things however she wanted.
Oh, cool.
At three, she was a chef. She would go and she'd make herself things. And sometimes she was emulating her parents, you know, try this thing I made.
Oh.
What are the ways to do that around money so that kids actually get to make their own choices rather than having adults simply tell them this is what you have to do?
So with my own daughter, I took a little bit of the like medical teaching approach of you watch it done, then you do it with help, and then you do it by yourself kind of a thing. And so she's been coming to the grocery store with me since she was born, basically. You know, all along, I've been narrating what I'm doing out loud. We call it sports casting in my family, you know, so it's like, ah, let's look at the limes here. Which lime is the best lime? This lime doesn't feel very good. This lime looks good. You know, that kind of a thing. It's the thing that when people don't realize that you have a kid with you, they're like, who's that crazy lady? And then they're like, oh, never mind. She's just a mom. Anyway, so we've been sports casting kind of all along. I took that as the like watching it done. At some point, she became old enough that I was asking her to help me do things like that. Like, can you help me pick which one of these mustards should I get? You know, which one of these vegetables look good? And that kind of a thing. Should we get this or should we not get it? I was involving her in the conversation. Now she's old enough and good enough that even in the grocery store setting, which is, you know, it's not even like toys or something, even in the grocery store setting, she can help me make decisions about comparison shopping. Which one of these is a bigger number? Which one of these is a better deal? Which one looks like a better thing? She can't do everything in the store, but there's definitely things that she can do independently even. Like I could tell her, hey, go get us this thing. And she'd go and get the right one. I think that kind of like modeling, teaching really early on. I know our parents had the idea of like raising kids to the level of equals, like treating them from very early ages, like they're a complete person who's capable of doing anything that they want to do. I think with that mentality, it's very easy to find opportunities to empower them with real choices. If you trust that, look, if I give them $16 of pennies, she's going to learn something from it. She's going to do something with it. She's going to, and just trusting her in that decision-making process, both to make a mistake, if it's a mistake, or to succeed, if she can succeed. And either way, it's going to be a helpful part of the journey of learning how to have a healthy relationship with money.
One thing that I notice coming up is that for a lot of people, money is not a place where they play, but it's often a source of pain. And our current monetary system certainly has elements that are not set up in a good way and cause people a lot of pain. Mm. I'm wondering how you navigate the aspects of money that are challenging or difficult or not set up in a way that necessarily benefits people with kids.
Yeah.
How is it that you navigate that?
step one is just to talk really openly with your kids about it and really factually about it. There's a sense in which you don't want to burden them with the emotional issues that you have. So if you haven't worked through a bunch of things and you're really emotional about it, and you find that when you're explaining it, you're emotionally talking about money, I think even just talking factually about the fact that you're emotional can help. Like, you can probably hear that I'm a little anxious about this, and, you know, really it would be better if, and even just kind of mothering yourself out loud. We do a lot of sports casting in my house. I think talking really openly about it, though. So if there is something that doesn't serve well, it's okay to be like, yeah, this is a really weird thing our society does. And I don't know that it's the best way to do it, but it's what we're doing. So whatever. This is how we hire a lawnmower. This is the weird way that we manage to get food. You know, it's just, I think it's just talk really openly about it all. And, you know, kids challenge your understanding of the world, because it'll be like, why is there mist outside? Suddenly, you have to know a lot about a lot of different things in order to explain why there's mist outside. So they do challenge you and push you to kind of be a low-level expert in a lot of different areas, or demonstrate how to find the answer. So I think that'll definitely come up with money. There'll be things that they'll ask and you'll be like, I don't know, I've never thought about that before. You know, even me as a financial planner, sometimes I get asked questions and it's like, that's really fascinating. I've never had that thought about money. But I do think that by just being that open and honest with your child, treating them like they're an equal who just doesn't know everything yet, I think you're able to navigate most of that pretty effectively.
It sounds very similar to the saying I've heard, that your parents are essentially a guide for their children. And often parents act like, I'm in charge of you, so I get to tell you what to do, as opposed to like, I've just been here longer, so I know a few more things. I can give you what I know. And I'm also curious how you handle the emotional needs kids might have around money. Because I'm sure a lot of parents have had the experience of going into a candy store or a toy store, and the kid says like, I want that. And you're like, I don't know if I can give you that. They get very upset.
Right.
They want that. And like, well, why can't I have it? It's right there. I could pick it up and just walk out with it.
It's super hard sometimes.
Why can't you give it to me?
I think families who don't have very much money have it a little easier in some ways, because the honest answer a lot of times is like, we can't afford it. And it's like an easy way to kind of just shut it down. Kids can understand pretty early on, we can't afford it. But when you have a lot of money, you can't afford it. So you don't get the cop out anymore. You can't be like, well, we can't afford it. That's not actually the reason that we're not getting it. We're not getting it for some other reason. And sometimes that open, honest conversation is not one that's, it's not one that's easy. You have to be like, well, I can tell that it's worth it to you, but it's not worth it to me. It costs too much for how much I want it. It's an awkward interaction there. But I feel like explaining it, you know, can help. So it's like, or it might be that you think, well, you want it now. I don't know if you'll still want it and play with it in a week. And so that might be the reason why you're not wanting to get it. Anyways, I think explaining it does help. It does help in the moment. The times when I have failed to know why I didn't want to get it are harder, definitely harder conversations. Also, I think it helps if the kid actually has money. So the question turns from like, mommy, will you buy this to me, to like, do you have enough money to get it? So the more that you can empower your children with an actual budget, it can help. That being said, if you have a kid who hasn't quite learned how to spend their money in ways that maximize their happiness, they will frequently be broke and frequently not have enough money to buy the thing. And then they'll try to turn the conversation back on you and be like, well, I don't have enough, mom, but I know you do. So let's have the same conversation anyways.
Adults frequently have the same problem. There's a lot of things I'd like that I can't afford.
Right, exactly. When you think about it that way, most of the problems that kids are having are ones that adults are having as well. So it is a very, it's just a human problem. You're just trying to teach them how to cope with that problem. Like, yeah, there's stuff you want that you're not going to get. What are you going to do about it? You know, how are you going to handle that? There's always going to be another thing that it would be nice to own if it were free to you.
How do you handle the question of how kids, and I guess people in general, make money? So much of what people do that makes money is incredibly relative. So I know people who work incredibly hard who do not get paid very well. And I know people who do consulting that get paid $10,000 for an hour of conversation.
Right.
You know, on some level, that doesn't make sense. And on another level, according to the relative perception of the buyer, like, they feel like they're getting $10,000 of value out of this consulting session. And according to the way the market is set up, this person who's working like 60 hours a week doing manual labor is not generating above minimum wage. So how do you handle the question of like making money and that sort of, you know, if I want more money, how do I get it?
Right. Yeah. So at least in my house, we've employed my daughter as a household employee. And so what that means is a household employment is an IRS term. It means...
Yes. Some people are going to get a little scared when you say that and think you have child labor. So let's be clear.
It's jobs like babysitting, caretaking, cooking, housekeeping, like maids, nannies, private nurses, yard workers, those kinds of like Downton Abbey style jobs is like household employment. Parents are allowed to employ their kids and have it count as earned income. And there's all sorts of special rules that make it so that you're exempt from FICA and Medicare, Social Security type payroll taxes. And anyways, there's a whole bunch of like reasons why it ends up being both advantageous in all directions.
I want to add some clarification. You're describing the way that the IRS and legal groups see the very common practice of like, hey, I'll give you $15 if you do your chores.
It's not quite, I'll give you $15 if you do your chores, in the sense that there are jobs that you're expected to do because you're a member of the family. Your child is expected to clean his room or expected to dress himself in the morning. And those are examples of things that sometimes parents might write like on a chore chart, but that's not employment because it's the child's family responsibility. But then there's other things that are like, it's 100% my responsibility as mother of the family. And it's my job to do. And it's also my prerogative to pay another person to do it. Those are examples like, it's my job to do the laundry. Like I do the laundry in the house and I fold the laundry in the house. If I wanted to pay somebody to do the laundry, that would actually be totally fine because it's my job in the house. So we pay my daughter sometimes. I'll pay her to fold the laundry for me. I'll be like living out of my laundry hamper if I didn't pay someone to do it because I forget to fold it or whatever. So those are examples of like a household employment. So we pay her to do jobs that are not her chores. They're my chores or my husband's chores to do. We'll pay her a wage in order to do those jobs for us. And she knows what the list is at any given point of like, these are the things that I don't like doing that I would always be willing to pay someone to do. And so anytime I need to fold the laundry, for example, I'll say, hey, would you be willing to fold the laundry for me today? Here's what I'd be willing to pay you. She gets the choice. Does she want to do it for that? So normally our going rate is normally a quarter for most jobs.
I appreciate the choice element because I think that there'd be some ethical issues if you were not offering the choice.
Yeah, no, she's employed at will. So just like, you know, housekeeper who says, I'm not coming in today, I feel sick. And you're like, tough luck, you have to clean your own house. She can say she doesn't want to come in anytime she wants. She's employed at will. I can also choose not to hire her and be like, whatever, I'm going to do it myself. So I'll offer it to her and she gets to make the choice. And then that makes it really interesting because when she doesn't have enough money to buy something, a lot of times she said no to doing a lot of jobs throughout the course of the week. You know, she'll have said that she didn't want to help me with the dishwasher and she didn't want to do the laundry and she didn't want to sweep up the garage and, you know, things like that. And it'll be like, look, we offered you enough jobs that you could have made like $3 this week and you would have been able to buy that toy. But you didn't take any of the jobs. So that's why you don't have enough money to buy the toy now. And she also very much has the concept, I think, from this experience that people will pay for things that sometimes you like doing. So for example, we have a garden and we have certain things that we forage from our yard that we put in salads. And sometimes I'll pay her to forage for me. So I'll pay her to, can you go harvest the carrots? Or I'll pay her to, hey, can you go pick the wild, we've got like blue violets in our yard that we put in salads. And she likes those jobs. So she's like, oh, amen. I'm going to definitely do those. So she has, I think even in those kinds of lessons, she has the concepts of, sometimes people pay you to do things that you love. Man, you would do that for free, maybe you'd do it without even having to be paid because you love it so much. And sometimes you get paid to do things you really don't like. And sometimes the wage is not quite enough to compensate it. Like she hates unloading the dishwasher. I do too, but she really doesn't like it. And she'll complain sometimes the whole time she's unloading it about how much she doesn't like it. Like this dish is wet, you know, as she's taking them out. And so I think the quarter earned on unloading the dishwasher is hard earned. I mean, she does not enjoy that, but the quarter earned from foraging, you know, the carrots or the violets out in the yard, man, whew, that went by like a breeze. So I do think she's learning a little bit of that relative value thing.
Learning which tasks she's willing to work for and which she isn't.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny, as we're having this conversation, I'm realizing like I had to do a lot of stuff growing up I didn't get paid for. Like I had some different lessons learned around money. And I'm like, oh.
It's true, yeah.
I need to adjust some beliefs there.
Yeah, it's a very different experience having like a chore chart that's, you know, because when we were growing up, we had a chore chart that was like clean your room, you know, clean the bathroom, empty the cat litter. And it was a little bit keyed to how much we got paid, but it was also just expected. Like you should right. do these things. We have those things too. We have things that we expect her to do, like pick up after herself. No one's ever going to pay her to do that. So we're not going to do it now. It doesn't make sense. That's a life skill she has to have without the compensation there. Whereas for something like cleaning up someone else's room, well, that could be her full-time career if she wanted to. You know, there's people who definitely earn that wage. So yeah, it is a different experience though, that chore chart. You must do these things versus the being paid to do something that's not your responsibility.
This ties a little bit into the question of how is it you find what your kids love doing that they might also someday be able to make a career out of. I'm reminded of a story of parents brought their daughter to a counselor and they said, she can't sit still in school. She can't focus. She can't get any work done. We don't know what to do. And the counselor said, well, let's go talk outside for a minute. But as he left, he turned the radio on and the music was playing from it. And he could see through the window to his office that when he was talking with the parents outside, the little girl immediately got up and started dancing. He said, I'm sorry, but I think your daughter is actually a dancer. She's not a student or an academic. And this woman, you know, daughter went on to become like a very famous choreographer. Yeah. A lot of the times I think parents have an idea, especially like middle class, oh, you need to be a doctor or a lawyer. And these are the things that pay money. But like you might actually have a child who's gifted in a different way. So how do you find that gift that they can actually turn into something they do with their life?
I think you just have to expose them to everything, you know? I mean, how did you find out what you were going to do with your life? Well, you just tried a bunch of stuff and, you know, at any given point you had the thing that you liked the most. Then there's another thing that might come along and actually that's the thing that you like the most. So I think just lots and lots of exposure to everything. When my daughter was very little, like only a few months old, people would sometimes start saying like, oh, I wonder if she'll be a whatever because of some very small, you know, like maybe she babbled something that sounded a little bit like something that reminded them to say that. So they'd make these leaps, but they'd normally leap to something that was, you know, doctor, lawyer, something really high student debt and high salary.
Right.
We had a standard response, though, that we would say to help keep us grounded in the fact that she could be anything. We'd say, oh, no, we think she's going to be a kickboxer. And it was our way of just changing the whole conversation. We tried to pick something that people wouldn't normally come up with. No, she's going to be a kickboxer. And it helps ground us in the fact that who knows what your kid is going to be? Like, you don't know. You can't make any guesses. Even now, she's going on 5. I don't know what she's going to do. You know, she's got tons of interests. She's got tons of ways that she could add value to the world, but I don't know.
Well, you also don't know what careers are going to be around in 20 years.
That's so true.
I have a lot of friends now who work in cryptocurrency. That did not exist 20 years ago.
Right.
I saw a job listing recently for $120,000 a year as a meme maker. It was for this company whose marketing strategy involved generating tons of memes for their product. Can you imagine, you know, you're a kid, you're just like making ridiculous memes in your room and your parents are like, what are you going to do for a job? It's like this, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, it's true.
Like I'm going to make crazy memes. And like 20 years from now, that might be a job. And like now there's people whose job is like TikTok influencer.
Right, influencers.
Or yeah. You know, all sorts of things. So how do you also, I guess, support your kids in doing the thing that maybe you don't even know exists, but could be their life path?
I mean, in my own journey, I feel like homeschooling is one of the ways that we can do that, at least early on. Because, you know, when you go to school, even now, they've made kindergarten less about play and more about rigorous studies these days. I think that keeping them back from that for a little bit so that they can just continue to explore and learn. Before having kids, I always thought teaching kids was kind of like labor. And, you know, it was like teachers are paid for a reason. Like it's really, really tough work. And it is tough work to teach 20 kids in a classroom. It definitely is. But when you have one kid and you only have that one kid and it's your child and you know them really, really well, there's the chance. It's not always true for every kid, but there's the chance that it's actually not that hard. If you have a kid who's super interested in learning and who is just open to learning new things, open to experiencing new things, it can actually be super, they can be very self-motivated in teaching themselves. It's every parent-child combination is a new combination that's never existed before, and every single teaching relationship is a new one. And so you never know, having a kid is kind of like putting up a Craigslist ad and being like, hey, whoever comes first, we'll take you in and we'll support you for 18 years. You have no idea who's going to take you up on the offer. You know, depending on who's taking you up on the offer, I do think that keeping them out of academics for a little bit, out of like that academic environment and in it at home, means that they can figure out where their passions really lie and, you know, who they are before. I mean, you and I have both read Gatto's about how, you know, school teaches you unwritten lessons that it's really hard to unlearn.
You're referencing The 7 Lessons School Teacher by John Taylor Gatto, which I've mentioned his name on the podcast before. It's someone who's very brilliant in his critique of the public school system.
Yeah. So, but it's really hard to unlearn those lessons that school teaches you. And so I think that a little bit of homeschooling at the start can potentially help make them resilient towards those lessons of education. Formal schooling, maybe, is the right term.
I'm curious, if you give kids opportunities to make money in some way, apart from you. I mean, there's always the cliched one of like setting up a lemonade stand outside. One of the things that I've noticed in my own life is that there are people who will pay me to do the things that I want to do, but connecting with them is sometimes a challenge because you have to find someone who values what it is you do. You know, I gave the example earlier of someone who gets paid like $10,000 for consulting. They're able to do that because they know someone who has that amount of money and sees that amount of value in what they're doing. But there's other people who they couldn't give it away for free because they just don't, like, that's not what they want. How is it that you handle the question of who's paying, essentially? I'm also thinking of, there's people I know who growing up made a lot of money buying and selling things like baseball cards or Pokemon cards, and like that was their first business. So how is it you give kids the opportunity to do those sort of things where it's not just you teaching them something by giving them money, but actually they're doing it for real? They're actually going and starting a business in some way.
You kind of have to foster the entrepreneurial spirit in your child before you can totally get to that point. And so my daughter's still in the early stages of that, so I don't have firsthand experience in like facilitating a career.
She's probably a little young for it.
Yeah, so I don't have the firsthand experience there. But I know that most entrepreneurs are really good at risk taking. So I do think that like helping manage fear in your child's life is one of the first ways of getting them to being that entrepreneur who can kind of invent that career for themselves that they really love. And one element of teaching risk-taking is basically not learning the unwritten lessons in school. A lot of school is about not taking risks. Like, don't write an English paper that has a brand new idea your teacher has never heard of, because you will fail because you didn't say the right thing in the paper. You know, you don't want to go out on a limb and take a risk because you might just fail. And it's better to get an A in school. So I do think that at home, you want to facilitate the environment that promotes taking risks. So sometimes your child is going to take a risk. Like, really young kids take risks all the time. They're going to climb up on the back of the couch and they're definitely going to fall off of it because they're not balanced enough yet, you know, but they made the attempt. And how you respond to that kind of risk, how do you respond to them trying something really scary and failing, is going to be one of the lessons that teaches them whether or not they should be an entrepreneur. So you want to have kind of pre-prepared yourself for the fact that your child is going to take a risk at some point and they're going to fail at it, or they might succeed at it, but they'll probably fail a couple of times. And you want to have been mentally ready to be supportive of them in the fact that they took a risk. So we try to praise, for example, rather than praising the outcome, we try to praise the effort. So, you know, that's like a really simple thing that you can just take in. So it's not, oh, that picture is really pretty. It's, wow, you've been working on that a really long time. Kind of shift the focus. You can still compliment, you know, if she's like, how do you like the hair? You can be like, that's really pretty. Like that, you don't have to censor yourself. But at the same time, focusing on the journey that it takes to get somewhere, we think helps promote that risk-taking. Like, it's fine that you fell off the couch. That was really brave of you.
You have to be comfortable with your child taking risks. And it reminded me that one of the big criticisms of the millennial generation that I've heard older generations make is, oh, you guys got participation trophies growing up. And it's like, because the parents couldn't handle their children trying something and failing. Like, right. That, who's giving out those trophies? It was the parents unable to handle the fact that their kids would try something and fail. Right. And then the kids never got that lesson of trying and failing. And so there's all sorts of like stuff that comes out later in life because, well, I didn't realize it was going to be this hard because you never have the opportunity to try something that was too hard.
Right. Yeah, there's the concept of like the helicopter parent who's always there trying to make sure that things are okay. But millennials had like the steamroller parent who went in front, you know, and just made the ground smooth. You never even realized that it had been smoothed for you before you got there. So definitely like let there be some bumps in the road.
There was also sort of a bait and switch with the millennial generation where they were told, if you go to college and get a good degree, you will get a good job and you'll have money. And then what happened was they took on lots of student debt and then there were no jobs. Right. And they were like, what, this is not what you guys told me. This is the opposite. And they're like, well, no one owes you a job. It's like, but you told me I would get one.
Right.
So there's a bit of a gaslight and bait and switch there.
Yeah.
I'm wondering too how to handle, it's one of those things, I guess you need to be careful what stories you tell your kids about money because they might turn out not to be true. Mm-hmm. And I'm especially thinking now about the fact that COVID has changed the job market for a lot of people.
Right.
And there is massive inflation in the future where your money may not have the purchasing power it used to. So I'm wondering how both for the generation that's coming up now and the people who are adults and parents now, how we handle those changes where what we used to believe about money might change very rapidly in the near future. And of course, cryptocurrency is another place where it might change very rapidly, but not everyone knows what those changes will be. Some of them could be big surprises.
Yeah.
So how is it you handle that?
Well, I think at any given point, you do the best you can with the information that you have. And so I think also demonstrating to your kids the times when you didn't have all of the information and you ended up changing your mind is another helpful way of, again, like modeling that disappointment and like when your expectations don't come true. I do think that like that open, honest communication with your child can solve just so many conceptual problems. Like a lot of times parents think that certain subjects are adult subjects, or maybe they're just taboo. Like you don't want the neighbors to know and you're worried that your kid's going to talk about it with them. But at the same time, I think trusting your kids with a wealth of information, just kind of everything that you have going on with you, it just empowers them. Even moments like I got upset when I was parenting and I made a rule that I really shouldn't have made. It was a dumb one. Like that didn't make any sense. So even just being willing to be like, yeah, I was angry before and I said this, but that's not right. Like I shouldn't have said that, and being willing to take it back. I think modeling that kind of, I didn't know then what I know now. And because of what I know, I'm going to do things differently than what I said I was going to do. I think that kind of modeling teaches a lot about the resilience, you know, how to be resilient in the face of disappointment or how to be humble in the face of your own mistakes.
That's a good relationship skill in general.
Yeah.
To be able to say, I was wrong.
It's true. Yeah.
I did something wrong.
I've heard the advice that parenting really well is like being the CEO of a company. There's no doubt that you're the CEO. No one doubts you there. So you don't have to like throw around your power. You know, you don't have to squash people's dreams. Like, how would you want a good CEO? Well, that's how you should be treating your kids. So if they have an idea and it's a really good idea, it's one you didn't think of, rather than being like, no, I'm not going to do that. I didn't think of that idea. You're like, oh my goodness, I'm so glad you're a part of the team. It's amazing you're part of this family. Like, let's do that idea. That's a great idea. Anyways, I think that kind of can channel that like effortlessly in charge. You just are in charge. So you don't have to worry about proving anything to anyone.
It seems to me there's two parts of setting your kids up for financial success. One is the mindset and ideas that you teach them. And then the other is what you start them with. And the mindset might be more important because there's definitely been people who were born into very rich families who blew that wealth and did not lead very successful lives because like they weren't taught well, they didn't have the emotional skills. I also think a lot of the times people blow their money because of some sort of personal problem, like addiction, which again, often stems from, you know, emotional needs that weren't met in childhood. If you've taught your kids the right things and you're doing the things that you need to meet their emotional needs. What can you also do to set them up with a good start around money to make sure that they might not be starting at zero?
So there's a couple of different financial planning things here. So one is, in order to set them up well for future education, if you want to do college or something, because of the short time horizon, you've got 18 years, to get the college funding made. It is really best to start saving for college as soon as your kids are born, which is not something that your kids can do for themselves. So it is really helpful to open a 529 plan, which is a technical account that helps you save college savings. It's normally gives you state tax deductions. What's even better is that sometimes for parents, it's a little hard to do that. Sometimes the grandparents are able to do those contributions easier, and they're probably looking for a way to get involved. If your own parents are financially stable and have lots of extra money and they're just like waiting to buy your kids the world, directing them towards the college savings account might be a good way to help them get started. So definitely college savings would be one of the first ones to think about. Beyond that, I do think that mindset obviously is super valuable. And if you do want to save actual money for your child so that you're going to set them up maybe with like a starter business money or some sort of starter house money, there's another type of account that's called a custodial account, or sometimes it's called an UGMA, which is like Unified Gift to Minors Act. Different custodians will call them different things, but you can open that and that'll be money that you control until your child becomes a certain age, and then they get to control it. But the whole time it's legally their money. And so that's another way that you can save for them. A little bit saved early on and invested can grow to quite a big sum by the time it's theirs. So you can always, like, for example, I opened an UGMA account for my daughter and we just put the money that grandparents gave us in it. Somebody would give her a little bit of money as like a "you were just born" gift, and we just put it in the UGMA. Some people will have spending needs where it's like, no, this is to help with diapers. Go for it. If the budget is already set for your family, saving it for your kid is another way that you can get it. There's a lot of problems in life, and some of the problems money can solve. So saving a little bit of money for your child may be able to solve one of those problems in their life.
I know that there are probably some people in my audience who really appreciated the parenting things that you were saying. And the moment big financial terms came out, they were like, I don't know how to do any of that. For people who maybe don't have a background in finance or haven't ever done these things before, is there an easy way that they could do it? Is there a way that they could learn? Is there one of those things that, like, if they were only to do one, that would be the thing that they should do?
Yeah. So if you're the type of person who doesn't know finance, what you should actually do is secure your own retirement, because no one will loan you money for your own retirement, but they will loan your child money for college. So if you're really like, I don't know money, you should look into funding your own retirement account. So a Roth IRA, you open one, put in at least a dollar and just fund your Roth. So that would actually be like step zero would be see if you can secure your own retirement. Because if you secure your own retirement later, you can help your child with whatever financial problem they're having because you've already set yourself up for success. But this is a little bit like put on your own oxygen mask first. You need to secure your own retirement because out of your retirement savings, you can always help your child with medical bills or whatever the problem is that they have later. If you don't have your own retirement set, then your child's going to be the one burdened with helping make sure that you make it and you're financially stable. So put on your own oxygen mask first. Look up what retirement accounts are available to you. You always have an individual retirement account available to you. That individual retirement account is just a good place to start. If you also have an employer, you can look obviously at your 401k plan, which if you don't know what that is, just ask your HR department. Do we have a retirement plan? And they'll probably tell you way more information than you want
to
know.
One thing that it occurs to me is that it would be very easy to save cryptocurrency for kids, because cryptocurrency, you would just hand the account off to them and you actually don't need to go through all of the same legal steps. I mean, maybe in the future, there'll be more regulation around it, but I'm curious if you know anything about that or the potentiality there.
I would be worried about the capital gains tax personally, because when you buy cryptocurrency, what price you bought it at is your cost basis. And then whatever it's worth, the difference between those two is the capital gains. And right now, if you had assets that where it was easy to realize capital gains, your child is in the 0% capital gains bracket. So there's no tax. You could just sell things and rebuy them and you'd end up with no tax owed. Whereas with cryptocurrency, it is a little bit harder to, I guess you could technically like move out and move back into it every now and again, but it seems a little harder to manage those capital gains tax that you would owe. And now I think on the 1040, when you're filing your taxes, you're required to say whether or not you engaged in transactions of cryptocurrency in order for your return to be complete. It just could become legally complicated.
We're in a bit of a wild west with cryptocurrency now. And I think in 20 years, some of these questions will be as far as how the government perceives cryptocurrency or what they expect you to do will probably be a little clearer.
As it is now, they kind of are like, we want our taxes, but we're not sure how to get them.
Yeah, they're like, we want some of it, but we don't even know if it's actually money. Because if we recognize it as actually money, then that might be bad for us.
Yeah. I would shy away from that, though, just because of all the unknowns. With a long enough time horizon, the stock market should be able to do just fine at growing the wealth for your child. I mean, if you think about it as funding their retirement, you can basically just take out the decimal to calculate what it would be in their retirement. You know, so if you save a dollar now, it could be $100 later.
Well, that was a question I wanted to ask is if you are saving for yourself or your kids, where should that money be going? What is the place to put it? Which I know is a really broad question that you probably get every day, but
yeah. After you get the account open and, you know, so you've picked either the Roth account, the 529 plan, the UGMA, something like that. So you've picked the account type. After that point, you should be able to get some really cheap index funds is what they're called. They have expense ratios on them. So it's some of the return that the company takes and that you don't get. You want to look for an expense ratio that starts 0.0 and then there's a number. So like 0.01. There'll be funds that cost like 1.29. Don't look at those. They're really expensive. You'll lose a whole bunch to fees. But if you just look at funds that start 0.0 and then it has a number, 0.09, those would be really good ones to start on because Morningstar did a study and they found that the lower the expense ratio, the more it correlated to higher returns. It was even better at predicting future returns than Morningstar stars. So Morningstar's doing the study. They're trying to see how effective their stars are at predicting future performance. They find that it would have been better for you to just pick based on expense ratio. Picking based on expense ratio is a perfectly fine way of doing it. You can pick something simple, like a lot of people have heard of the S&P 500. You could pick an S&P 500 fund. They're really cheap. They'll do pretty fine over the long haul. You could also just pick, there's some funds that are called total stock market. It literally means it owns a little bit of every company that's available on the exchange. Total world stock market would be every company in every country on the exchange. So if you want to get some massive diversification there, you can get a total stock market fund and own a little bit of the whole world. There's a lot of stuff that you can do that makes it easy gateways of getting started. I'd pick all stock funds if you're looking for the time horizon of a small child. So like the S&P 500, like the total stock, maybe even like a small cap fund, something like that, and then go from there. If you're really lost and you're like, I don't even know how to look up a ticker. On MuradaOnMoney.com, we have portfolio that's called the Gone Fishing Portfolio. And the idea there is it has recommendations of the specific products that you would buy. We're not associated with any of them. We're just doing it because we think it helps people. But it would be like, here's the Vanguard funds that we would recommend by default. You can put in your age or you can put in the amount that you want in stocks. It'll give you back, here's what we would buy. Here's what we'd recommend that you buy. And then you buy it once. And once a year, you rebalance. And it's a pretty simple way of getting started with investing.
That's helpful. One question that I know might come up for people is I think there's a stigma around kids who inherit a lot of wealth, and especially like a lot of beliefs about what sort of character or person that they become, that they're spoiled, that they don't know what they're doing. And some of that might come from the fact that they haven't been taught some of the financial lessons you're talking about. And also like there might be emotional problems in the house that money is being used to cover up and things like that. Because I can see that there's a belief in a lot of people of like there's a sort of a reluctance to set their kids up with that good a start and all sorts of beliefs around it. I know that when I've seen very successful people talk about, oh, I was able to get some support from my family when I started my business. It's like, oh, well, you privileged, you know, you had that. At the same time, like, I do want my kids to succeed. If they can turn a small amount of money into a huge pile of money, I want to be able to give that to them. How is it that you would handle the beliefs that parents have about setting their kids up with money and how to do that in a way in which the money supports the best version of that child rather than, you know, quote unquote, spoiling them, or rather than the money being used to cover something else up?
They say that people who care about equality, when they say that they care about equality, they either care about equality at the end, like equality of outcomes, or they care about equality at the beginning, an equality, at, you know, that you start in the same spot. And it's interesting because inheritance violates both of them.
Right.
You're not equal at the end of your life. So you ended up with more money than another person ended up with. And then now your children start in a better spot. So everybody is upset. Doesn't matter which equality you meant. Inheritance just violates it. And I think that definitely, like, our society needs to kind of come to terms with that fact and come to terms with, do we actually think that this is a problem? Because when you really think about it, it's like, should we really punish, you know, somebody who worked their whole life, whose main goal was to set their kids up for success? Should we really not let them do that? So I do think there's a little bit of soul searching that you can do in yourself to ask the question, like, why am I actually uncomfortable with this? What is it really? Because it might be some people don't have the goal of family as one of their main things. Like, the money isn't for your kids. And the upsetting part is thinking about, I have other things I'm trying to do with this. So it might be a life planning issue. There's a disconnect between what you feel like you should do and what you actually want to do. And reconciling those two to figure out, well, is what you should do, should you actually do it? Or is it just you feel like you need to, and actually the thing that you want to do is fine? So I think there's some soul searching there that can be done to reconcile your own feelings. If it's societal pressures that are keeping you from funding it, like you're like, well, what will the neighbors say when they find out that my kid has money? There's also some soul searching you can do there, because why does it matter what your neighbors say about your kid? Like, would you rather your kid be, you know, poor and destitute and have bills because, oh, but then the neighbors won't complain? You do need to kind of come to terms with it. We have a lot of weird hangups with money. And I think a lot of it comes from how it's been taboo for so long. I mean, it's really rare to have parents who openly talk with you about how much they make. It's really rare to know how much money your parents have. The number of my friends who just do not even know if their parents can retire, you know, it's a really high number. Even as adults, you may not know anything about your parents' finances. And in that way, it is kind of scary to think about other people maybe, like, knowing about how you've set up your kids or knowing how you've set up your household. But at the end of the day, you know, that vulnerability and openness, it's powerful and helpful in society. So even if there's somebody who makes fun of you because you're open, okay, shame on them.
It sounds to me like there's also a lot of pain that people have around money, and the open conversation would mean revealing that pain to someone else, and that pain might not get treated with the same level of care that you would treat someone's emotional pain. So if someone said that they, you know, weren't getting the kind of relationships and connection that they wanted, we might have sympathy for them. But if they said, I'm not making the kind of money I want, like, that's not treated as an emotional thing. It's like, well, are you lazy? Are you not working hard enough? Or are you a victim? Is the man keeping you down in some way?
Mm. Yeah.
So there's all these sort of social expectations that are then placed on that, as opposed to, like, oh, that must be really difficult for you. I can see why that would be upsetting.
We as a society have a really hard time validating people's feelings, it seems like.
Yes.
You know, just acknowledging you are feeling something and it is valid and okay to feel that.
Right. And then when you combine that with money, it's a new area where people are not able to have a conversation.
Yeah, it's a whole new level. Mm-hmm.
I notice, especially with a lot of the activists I know, there's a taboo around money, a sort of pride in, like, oh, we're funding this all by ourselves. And we're doing this really important cause, and it's all donations. It's just, you know, people kicking in their 20 bucks. When I hear that, I think if your issue is really important, you should let that billionaire give you a pile of money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you should like just take the money. If it's really that important, let them pay you for it. But there's, it's true. You know, there's beliefs. And I don't fully understand all the beliefs, but I'm curious how when you're with someone and you start seeing the beliefs that they have around money, first, how do you identify those beliefs? And then how do you reframe them or change them? And also, like, what are the common ones people have around money and especially, you know, working with their kids around money? I know I asked like three questions in one, so just answer the one that's most interesting to you.
Yeah, it's really broad. The things I think that a common one I've seen before is people having a sense of deserving things, like I deserve to have nice things or I deserve to be paid more. So there's a phrase in psychology that's called internal locus of control. It means that you personally believe that your own actions can change what happens versus an external locus of control. You think that circumstance and luck and society is dictating your own future. And I think I see a lot of external locus of control with money where it's like, oh, I don't have a good job because society doesn't pay very much for the thing that I'm doing. Versus the internal locus of control would say, I've decided to take the particular job that I've decided to take. And it doesn't necessarily pay what I want it to pay. But if I wanted to, I could get a different job. For an internal locus of control, it doesn't actually have to be true that you're capable of getting a different. You just believe it. Like you believe that you could. That empowerment of believing I have control over what happens in my life is kind of a starting point for finding the career and the life that you want. Just believing that what you do makes a difference on what will happen to you. It's such a powerful tool that I think a lot of people are missing. And it's not to say that society doesn't have barriers. It does have barriers. It has barriers to tons of people. The stronger your internal locus of control, though, which is kind of best thought of as like a personality thing even, like the stronger you're able to cultivate your internal locus of control, the more that you become kind of blind to the barriers and you're just going to try to do it anyways. Sure, there's maybe a healthy middle, but at the end of the day, having a stronger internal locus of control when it comes to money and money decisions is going to help you get farther. I've heard it said in a lot of women's groups that I'm in, men sometimes have a higher salary because they're willing to ask for one.
I've heard that too.
Women are sitting there and they just take the salary that they're given. So in women's groups, it's a super common thing to just encourage people like, no matter what salary they quote you, do the quick math in your head and ask for 10% more. Like that's the like number one advice that they give you. Just like, no matter what, just ask for 10% more and see what happens. And that's an internal locus of control way of thinking. Like you have control over how much salary you get paid and you could ask for more versus the external locus of control. I was offered this salary. This is what the universe has dictated will be my salary. I will have this salary and complain about it to my friends over coffee. Cultivating more and more of a I can control my destiny mindset helps you with money and is a common barrier that people have to getting what they really want.
The opposite of the internal locus of control I've heard called learned helplessness. Mm. We definitely do a lot of things to children that teach that, which is learned helplessness comes from when you're a child and something happens and you are helpless to do anything about it. Then you learn that you're helpless, but as an adult, you may not be as helpless as you were as a child. It's just that, you know, when you were tiny, there was nothing you could do. And when you're an adult, there's something you can do.
Yeah. The psychology study that found learned helplessness was dogs jumping over a bar. And there was one side that was electrocuted and one side that's not. And the dog jumps over the bar and then he's safe. After learning that he can jump over the bar to not get electrocuted, they make both sides electrocuted. And then the dog sits down and they call that learned helplessness because he stops jumping over the bar. When you think about it from a parenting mindset of how can you make your children not learn that horrible lesson, you have to always make sure that there's a right answer for them. Hmm. Sometimes when a kid has done something wrong, you could sometimes as a person, you know, you can just be upset and you want them to feel shame. Like it's an instinct I think humans have. I have it. It's like, you wronged me and I want you to feel bad about it.
Right.
Well, that's about to teach your kid learned helplessness. Because what's the right answer for them to do? there. It's to sit down on the ground and be sad.
Because if they tell you I did something wrong, then they're going to get punished. And if they don't tell you, then they're doing something wrong and they're going to get punished.
Right. So there are parenting moments where your natural human response is about to teach them learned helplessness. And you do need to be like, whoa, there, what's their right answer? Like, what do I actually want from this person?
It's so interesting because most people would not think that that moment has something to do with money, but I could totally see someone generalizing that experience to how they relate to money as an adult.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you learn that what you do doesn't have an effect on what happens to you, you know, that's another moment when you're not going to take the risk to be the entrepreneur. You're not going to make the decision to get a higher salary. Yeah, it definitely, it has ripples.
Now I'm thinking about, I had an experience similar where I felt like I did everything right and I still got the negative consequence. And I noticed in my own psychology, I went the opposite direction of like, well, if I do everything right and I get the consequence and I do everything wrong and I get the consequence, why don't I do everything wrong? Like, we'll see how you like that, which is how you get rebellious kids, right? If you're, they're like, well, if I'm going to get the consequence, I might as well get to do the bad thing.
Right.
Because then I get to have the fun of doing the bad thing. And if I'm going to get the consequence anyway.
Right. It's true. Yeah. It's a different kind of learned helplessness. It's like learned rebellion.
Learned rebellion. We've coined a new psychology concept.
Yeah.
We're coming up towards the end. Is there anything else that you want to talk about that I didn't ask you about that you felt like would be really interesting or anything that you want to go into that we haven't covered yet?
I think one thing that we didn't talk about yet is I do think it's important that you don't use money as a punishment. Because people don't come and rob adults when they do something wrong. You know, it's not like, oh, you did something wrong. I guess there's some fines, but it's not like, it's not a normal occurrence. Yeah. It's not a normal thing that you want your kid to learn. You want them to learn property rights and ownership of their own assets. So I do think it's important there. And in the same way, I don't think it's great to buy behavior with money. If you're trying to make your kid be nice, I don't think it's a great idea to be like, what if I paid you to be nice to me? I just think don't go there. So money as a behavior manipulator, I think that's going to mess up some of the relationship that they're forming with the money.
I can totally see that. And it's funny as you say that, I'm thinking about the government does all of these bad things.
They do.
And even now I'm thinking about like, we'll give you free stuff if you get the COVID vaccine. You want a donut? You want some beer? Like,
right?
I thought
right.
It was for my health. Why would I have donuts?
Yeah, why would I do it to get healthier? A donut? Right. Yeah, I agree.
So there's a way in which the negative attitudes that people teach children around money also are represented in the way that adults relate to it.
Well, there's a sense in which we know where the instinct comes from. If we've got a government that's modeling it for us, then it does trickle down.
It's in the culture and it's in the adults who are in those positions as well.
In the same way, I think it's important that if your child wants to buy something, I think it's important not to loan them money in advance. First of all, it opens up a whole new relationship dynamic because now it's like, you owe me, you know? I think that's a hard relationship to carry as a parent.
And then you're a parent / debt collector.
Right. So I think loaning, and also I think most kids, they don't quite have the concept of paying it back later. Like, we're still cultivating the like remembering that there's going to be a future a month from now, you know, kind of mentality in young kids. And so I think they're not quite at an age where they can really make the decision like, I'll work for a month to pay back for a thing that I had now. It's not a great relationship to have. So I think if you're making them buy it with their own money and they don't have enough money to buy it yet, I think just make them save for it. You know, if it's something that's truly that they really want, that you really want to make sure that they have, you always have the option of buying it for them. So if it's, you know, oh no, but it's on sale and it's only available now. You always have the option of gifting it to them or buying it for them. But I think separate that from, I don't think loan them money for it. And in the same way, if there's something that you really want them to have, I don't think that you should make them pay for it. I know some people who make their kids pay for the clothes that they get. They'll give them enough money that they can pay for everything. And then they're like, well, now pay for your clothes. But then they're also kind of dictating like how many clothes their kids have. And oh no, you can't wear that. That doesn't fit my standard of modesty of what you should wear and things like that. No. If you want them to have it, that's your purchase. Like, let them purchase the things that they want to purchase.
It's interesting because it sounds like what you're doing as a parent is you are modeling their relationship to money. And initially, you're the only person who is providing for them materially. What also happens emotionally is initially, You're the person whose job it is to meet their emotional needs. And as they get older, they will meet more people and make more friends. The most important relationships in their life will be with other people.
Right, yeah.
It sounds like the same is true of money, that initially you provide for their material needs. As time goes on, they'll have the ability to meet their own needs and to work with other people to get the things that they need. And eventually,
right,
they're going to provide for themselves or be provided for by someone else.
Yeah, that's true. This is slightly off topic, but I've heard it said that a father is a child's first friend, because there's a sense in which when baby's first born, they don't realize that mom's not part of them anymore. So there's a sense in which mom doesn't count. Mom is just part of me. And later I'll learn that she's not part of me, but she's part of me for all intensive purposes. But a father is that first friendship relationship. Like, he's not feeding you. He's not part of you. But you like him and he likes you. And, you know, that's that first friendship. And that's one reason why dads get to model. What does it mean to have a friend?
It's good to know, since I'm having a kid soon.
Yeah, exactly.
Was there anything else you want to add before we finish up?
I mean, I always have more ideas, but we can stop whenever you're ready.
I always have more ideas too. Let me ask, if people like what you've said and they want to learn more, they want to learn more about how they can relate to kids and change their own relationship to money, where should they go?
Yeah, so I write a lot of articles. Most of my articles are published on maradaonmoney.com. So that's Marada, spelled just like Brendan's name, and then onmoney.com. And we have tons of articles. A lot of them are about kids and money, but then we also write about just general investments, finances. It's a wealth of resources. So we have a newsletter you can subscribe to, and it just mails out what comes out every week, or you can browse the backlog and see all the cool stuff we've written about.
One of my favorite articles you wrote was one called Customer Service Lessons from Parenting a Toddler.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot that adults can learn about how they treat one another by understanding how children need to be treated. Because most people are emotionally children on some level, or have parts of them that are emotionally children.
It's maybe even more accurate to say that most children are emotionally adults on some level.
We're very much the same.
Yeah.
That article was about how a lot of businesses and institutions and corporate entities treat people in ways that would make a toddler burst into tears.
Yeah.
Which,
it's true.
I've certainly experienced it when I'm talking to someone, and yeah. It's a good article.
Yeah, we as adults just aren't allowed to burst into tears, but sometimes we want to.
Right. Well, I think that what people call Karen behavior, or people who get really upset with customer service people, is an adult who's having that child reaction but knows they can't burst into tears, so they try to make the other person burst into tears.
Yeah, they turn aggressive.
I'm just going to take that emotion and project it on someone else.
That makes sense.
Well, thank you for coming on. Is there anything else you want to add before we finish?
That sounds good. Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on. Good talk.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan Marotta Show. If you liked this episode, please share it with someone else who would also like it. And then go on whatever platform you listen to the show on and leave a positive review. If you want to support the show directly, go to brendanmarotta.com/show and subscribe there. Paid subscribers get special unreleased bonus material and live events that are only available to them. Once again, that is brendanmarotta.com/show. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you all later.